Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Narnia Web Council. I'm your host, Rillian, and today we have Dr. Elwyn Ransom joining me. Hello, Dr. Ransom, how are you doing?
Hello, Rillian. I'm well, and looking forward to this momentous occasion. These big words are just, they're the end of me.
They didn't include momentous in third grade, did they?
No, they didn't, and I'm not going to make some ridiculous didn't even finish third grade joke here, but the thought did occur to me. Yes, momentous occasion, finishing up the film analysis.
Indeed. Yes, this will conclude our series on the Don Treader analysis. About time. The video is now available to rent and buy. I have not rented it or purchased it, but I have borrowed it from a friend, and I actually just finished watching the scene, basically most of what we're going to be discussing today. And, of course, I watched the film again before the last episode, and it hasn't really changed a lot of my opinions, but it helped me remember a few things. And so we're basically just going to proceed from the end of the sequence with the sea serpent to where they discover, not discover Aslan's country, but they reach Aslan and the whole ending there. And then we'll wrap up with just a few minutes with our final thoughts on the film. So, starting off, of course, after the sea serpent, we have Eustace in the water, and Reepy Cheep jumps in to join him, which, of course, brings up that memorable moment, I think, for all fans from the book, where Reepy Cheep jumps into the water for different reasons in the book, and he realizes that the water is sweet. And personally, I was just kind of, I guess that was one of those little moments where I just thought, ah, yes, I know what's going on here, because mm-hmm. I read the book, and that was kind of cool, that they at least included that little moment. Of course, it was part of the song that he sang as well.
I did enjoy the reference to the sweet water. As you said, it was when Reepy Cheep jumped in, a book fan could know what was coming, and in that case, they did not disappoint. Almost, though, to speak on behalf of those who didn't read the book, it was a little bit disappointing because, along with many other things, the film didn't give it as much airtime as a book fan might have hoped for, at least because the element of sweet water was just so poignant in the book, especially because, again, Reepy Cheep recited his rhyme. It was more public. Everybody else knew about it, not just Lucy. It wasn't so quiet as it was in the movie. If Reepy Cheep had said it longer, if we'd referenced it, at least once more in between, then we could have heightened that sense of anticipation for the sweet water. But, of course, same thing for Aslan's country as a whole. So I might have wished for more there if I had to do it over myself.
Well, I think you hit on a really key point because you mentioned the sense of anticipation. And that was one of my main criticisms earlier, was that that's something that's strongly lacking throughout the film, is there is no sense of anticipating reaching Aslan's country. You have that one mention of it, and this contrasts strongly with the book, where you have all these different factors. For one thing, you have Mirandu's daughter saying that you must go to the edge of the world and leave someone there. And then you have the sun is getting bigger and brighter.
I missed that too.
Everything, all these little things are building the sense of anticipation. And this was something, it was kind of the first little note. And I think that we get really through the whole film. And then Edmund kind of gives a line that I think really sums up the film's attitude towards Aslan's country, where Caspian looks off, they see the wave all way off in the distance and the lilies, and Caspian says, "Aslan's country." And then Edmund says, "Well, we've come this far." And I'm thinking, okay, so the purpose is completed. Oh, well, we've come this far. We might as well visit Aslan's country.
Time for a super bonus prize.
Congratulations. You've just destroyed the sea serpent. Your prize is one trip to Aslan's country.
All expenses paid on behalf of Carnival Cruise Lines. Yes.
But the thing that really does is kind of the attitude. It's, oh, isn't this cool? We get to go visit Aslan's country as a bonus.
Yes, 1,000 extra points. Now we're mixing metaphors, but
right. Well, I think that is kind of the attitude. And the finding Aslan's country is not part of the quest. It's not. It's Reepy Cheep's personal journey, but it's not. It doesn't directly involve everyone else. It just kind of ends up being that way.
Yes, and how did that make you feel, just as a book reader? I mean, even though, and let me say before we get too negative here, I mean, we'll go into this more later, but I really loved the visuals for Athlin's Country. For something so portrayed as so amazing in the book, I mean, they really got very close to it in the film, and I think that was the best you could do. And I really enjoyed the way it looked. I enjoyed a lot about the ending. However, mainly because I could kind of swap cartridges, if you'll pardon the old video game metaphor in my head. I swapped out what I just seen.
You have just dated yourself.
Yes, I know. I know. And that's kind of weird, but I swapped out one cartridge for the other. I swapped out movie cartridge for book cartridge, and if you do that, then the ending is much more enjoyable, because I could remember the sense of anticipation in the book and then see it come to life before me and see it paying off. So that's my positive, with, of course, a bit of a negative view, summary view of the ending, but I was just wondering how you felt that bonus idea of, like, Athlin's Country being a bonus instead of part of the mission altogether.
Well, it says something about what are there's a question of what are they doing, and then a bigger question of what are they living for.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the book, what they're doing is finding the Seven Lords, and that's really the initial purpose of the quest. But what they're living for honor, which is what they're why they are finding mm-hmm. the Seven Lords. They are also living with a desire for Aslan and that essence, that transcendent quality of Aslan, but beyond themselves, beyond their own world.
Yes.
That greater beauty, that greater adventure, that idea of whatever good things we have here, there is something more beautiful,
yes,
more great.
And it is worth giving up anything that we thought we had on our own just for one glimpse of that outside ourselves transcendent beauty.
Right. And I think that it's I'm not going to say it. On one hand, it's almost easy. Like, the first time, I didn't really even think of it that much after watching the film. Just even the you know, even with Edmund's comment, I didn't even catch it. But I think you don't walk away with nearly as much of that sense of longing that, especially that Reepy Cheep had,
mm-hmm.
and it transcends to the whole crew. It doesn't just, it's not Reepy Cheep's own little journey. It's all connected. It's one coherent picture there.
Yes, and it was part of why, at least on Ramandu's Island, part of why Caspian was able to appeal to the crew who would have otherwise gotten sick and tired of the whole voyage.
Right.
He tells them, hey, you're going to get to come back and tell your children that you saw Aslan's Country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And let's just quickly go into the visuals here. I thought, yeah, I think as far as how they did it, I remember seeing a still of this kind of silhouette of the children standing against the wave, and I thought, this is unbelievable. I always thought, how are they going to make the wave not look goofy? I mean,
yes.
Really? Because I can imagine it in my head. I think it just came across wrong on screen. It really didn't. I liked how they did Aslan's Country in the distance. You could see it, but it wasn't clear.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not something you notice instantly, but you have to kind of look for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked how they did it there. The special effects on Aslan there were easily the best special effects in the film.
Absolutely.
Besides the sea serpent. We'll talk about the transition back to our world later, mm-hmm. but the lilies, Glumpuddle had a problem with the lilies. I thought they looked great.
What was his problem with the lilies? I think I missed that.
He thought they looked a little fake and a little green screen.
Hmm.
Which they were fake and they were green screened. But
you mean they didn't actually find a lily lake or a silver sea somewhere and then put the boat in the middle of it and have the little path behind them and row through it and such? I would think they would have been able to find such a geographic landmark easily.
I thought visually it was just how I would have liked to see it.
I liked it. I love the lilies, and that's one of those key visual elements of the book that you can't leave out. And
right,
they left out several elements that you can't leave out, but at least they kept the
visually,
lily lake
though,
or the silver sea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, let's talk briefly. There's an addition here that is pretty different from the book. They add a new development with Caspian's character, where he comes to the shore, and Aslan offers him to go into Aslan's country and see if his father's there. And it's a little poignant beyond just "Yoo-hoo, Dad, are you home?" You know, but it's a very, very different from the book. Whereas in the book, Caspian cannot leave the ship. Mm-hmm. He can't. He's not allowed to leave the ship. He wants to. But they make it very clear to him, everyone, Drinian, Edmund, Lucy, Reepicheep, they all say, look, we're going to tie you up because you have a duty to your subjects.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about... I kind of have mixed feelings about it. What do you think about this little area with Caspian here?
Well, you may recall that the photos and I think even the trailer images mm-hmm. of Caspian with Lucy and Edmund and Eustace and Reepicheep were all released fairly early, and I don't remember whether it was that told me that Caspian was actually going to go along with them, or if I just sort of always knew. I think that I always assumed that they would change Caspian going along with them, because just going to show here that we're not completely against making a small plot change from book to movie. Whereas in the book it made perfect sense, and the story doesn't suffer at all from Caspian not being there. In fact, it gets a lot more intimate and more personal mm-hmm. with you know, Reepicheep and our three children from Earth. In a movie, that would have been difficult to pull off. Like, Caspian is one of our key characters here. Why are we leaving him behind? You know, it's kind of random.
Yeah.
So I was fine with them bringing him along. I didn't think that was a change that was... just to stick it to the book, or just to try to outthink the book or something like that. I was okay with that personally. As for the whole subplot thing, I don't know if you want to say that for part B of the question, but do you want to tackle that now? The whole see his father thing?
Sure. Right. I mean, yeah. That's kind of all does, and that's the reason that Aslan offers him a chance to go to his country.
Tacked on. We didn't get anything about it before. Well, we got like a few hints here and there, but
the scene with his father appearing and saying,
"That's right,
like your disappointment to me."
Yes, and why? I mean, it did seem, we've mentioned before, one of those things you learn in scriptwriter school. In case of character development, need break glass. You know, well, well, it's like an Inception. You know, how do we get to this? How do we get to this guy and make him do what we want him to do after he dreams this? Well, let's go for the father issue. That's always good. And for Inception, it worked. You know, they managed to make it not cliche, because it is cliche. And unfortunately, it's cliche because it's true. People do have father issues, but there are better ways to explore those themes mm-hmm. in a film. And in that, it was just, like I said, tacked on. It was kind of unsupported, like out of nowhere, right, Hook? You know, what? Father issues? Oh, he's had those all along. Oh, surprise.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I thought it was kind of, it's kind of a 20-second character arc of, boom, I want to go see my father. I need to know if he's in Aslan's country. I want to my relationship with him to be restored. He walks back, you know, I'm good now.
Yeah.
I there's an element of, you know, where he said, you know, comes back and does say, oh, well, I have a people that I need to take care of. And you could say, well, it does add something where, yes, it's the same reason he has to stay as in the book, and he comes to that realization in a different way. That I didn't really mind so much. I didn't mind him being there. I actually kind of appreciated him being there. I just thought that the dialogue, you know, I promise you I'll be a better king. You already are. Okay. Yeah,
nice self-esteem affirmation there, the name of the game.
It just didn't... It did kind of seem like it came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And I guess I would have... I would have rather it been more subtle with, you know, just why not just, because Ben Barnes, I will say, this was one of his better acting moments in the film.
I think he did a brilliant job with what he had, absolutely.
Yeah, he really did a good job, and I really like the character, even though in some ways I don't like the character of Caspian as much in the second one, I kind of do like the character of Caspian better in the mm-hmm. in the third one, I mean, than in the second film, just because... He seems more natural. He seems like he's really the character. I would have rather it been a moment, and I hate to compare, but I have to, of, you know, just there's no dialogue from Pippin or Merry or Samwise that they want to go with Frodo to the Undying Lands. Mm-hmm. But you can see it, and you can see that they wish that they could still be together. And, you know, I wish that they would still kind of just show that sense of longing
mm-hmm.
with Caspian wanting to go to Aslan's country, even wanting to go to our world at some point, and not have to, oh, I really want to go, okay, no, I'm good now, I realize I have people to lead.
I just thought of something else, too, and if I do this right, it's going to sound like I've been thinking about it for days or weeks beforehand, but rhetorical question here, why does Caspian want to go to Aslan's country in the movie? Why does he want to go there? It's to see his father. We have an instant, just add water, just add water, father problems, solution, fizz.
It's not because of Aslan.
No, it's not because Aslan's country is worth giving up everything to get to. And in the book, Caspian did want to go to Aslan's country, but it's almost with the attitude of someone who is, you know, doesn't want the responsibilities of real life. Who doesn't want to do what Aslan has given us to do now? To use a cross reference there, it's almost like he's wanting to kill himself. Almost, very similar. It's just in case, you know, the flip side of looking forward to heaven or looking forward to Aslan's country, to paradise, is that you cannot go there on your own time. And I think that was why C.S. Lewis put that in the book, because yes, Aslan's mm-hmm. country is wonderful, but it is up to Aslan to decide when he's going to take his people to his country. And even, you know, that's why Edmund, Lucy, and Eustace weren't able to go there either. Only Reepicheep was. So what is that? What does they get changed to in the movie? Similar to how the mission of the voyage, it's not to experience the thought of the experience seeing Aslan's country, it's to save Narnia, it's to defeat a evil green mist in order to put families back together, and mm-hmm. I won't repeat the whole monologue there about families, but I mean they know their market, and families like stories that talk about how great family is, and unfortunately some Americans, even American Christians, like the thought of family better than they like the thought of heaven or of what's ahead. So at least from the Christian perspective, I could see that it made perfect sense for them to switch out one goal for another. Mm-hmm. But just as a viewer and a Lewis fan, I wish they hadn't.
Yeah, I think we both liked having Caspian there, but it was just kind of an extra element that they just came mm-hmm. up with. That was somewhat formulaic and created some unexpected problems.
And they could have done it so well if Caspian had been standing there yearning to go to Aslan's country, because it's Aslan's country.
Yeah,
why wouldn't you
want
to go there if you're Caspian, the king of Narnia? And then he asked it, you know, you could resolve it the same way as they did in the movie. It's like, no, my place is back, you know, being king. It's a tough responsibility, but that's what I'm called to do now. Mm-hmm. And I look forward to going to Aslan's country and seeing Aslan whenever it is my time to do so.
Well, speaking of people going to Aslan's country, let's go to Reepicheep, because this is one of the most famous. There actually aren't that many times in the Chronicles where it actually concludes a character
mm-hmm.
story.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of characters where the reader just leaves them.
Yeah, like the Beavers
we don't
or Mr.
see
Tumnus
mm-hmm. the death of Tumnus. We don't see the death of the beaver. They just, you know, the story leaves them. The reader leaves them in the mm-hmm. Chronicles, and, you know, it just goes back to our world. This gives a complete conclusion to the story of Reepicheep in the book. It's very memorable. And I really think they were trying to be as... I think they were really trying to pay attention to the book and trying to follow that aspect faithfully, and I think they missed it.
Mm-hmm. I reluctantly agree, for reasons you're likely about to outline.
Well, one of the big differences is it's not, you know, why is Reepicheep going to Aslan's country? For one thing, he has this deep desire in his heart. It's something that he's never been able to shake.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Glumpuddle, I know he felt, well, it was trivialized to the point of, oh, I get to go to Disney World. Isn't that kind of cool? I don't see that. I think it was much more significant than just one more adventure in the film. But the point of the book is that he has this deep yearning, but also it's something that he is called to do. It's something that he was, you could kind of say, was kind of plucked out and chosen.
Mm-hmm.
That he is and everyone knows, he is the one who is going to allow the spell to be lifted from the three sleeping lords by going to Aslan's country and not returning.
Mm-hmm.
But here, you know, you have a real difference, just even in this one little selection of dialogue, where he says to Aslan, "I know I'm hardly worthy, but I would lay down my sword for the joy of seeing your country with mine own eyes."
Thank you for that line, scriptwriters. Thank you very much. I like that. I like that. Mm-hmm. I wish they said more about it beforehand, because otherwise it's just out of the blue. Go ahead. Sorry.
Aslan responds with, "My country was made for noble hearts such as yours, no matter how small their hearts be." Now, even there, it's probably because it's, well, made for noble hearts. Okay, that's a little bit vague. What does he really mean there? But there's a sense of, well, actually, Aslan's saying, actually, you are worthy. You know, you're noble enough to go to Aslan's country. And then the next line was what actually really irked me. And
this was Castan saying,
"No one could be more deserving."
Oh.
And then you have Edmund saying, "It's true."
Oh.
And then it really kind of bashfully goes, "Oh, well."
Oh! Death blow after death blow you handed me.
And it's just it's a different image in the book. There is nothing whatsoever in the book that alludes to or implies Reepicheep is going to Aslan's country because he was brave enough, because he was noble enough, because he was courageous enough.
Mm-hmm.
It has more to do with he is going to Aslan's country because this is the deepest yearning in his heart.
Yes, he doesn't care any longer about being courageous or being, you know, the greatest swords mouse in Narnia. He doesn't. He's had all these other adventures, and he now sees that they pale in comparison to Aslan's country. Same thing with his monologue earlier. Everything is worth getting rid of. Every adventure is worth nothing compared to the greatest adventure of Aslan's country. It's not that he's brave, he's courageous, all that stuff. But I cut you off. Please continue, because you were probably going to say that stuff anyway. Also,
well, no, it's you know, like even what you were saying about the sword. You know, in the course, you know, yes, he gets rid of the sword in the movie. It's sort of like, you know, for the fans, ching, and moving on.
Easter egg, hurrah!
Yeah,
that and the albatross.
But in the book, you know, it's, you know, this is Reepicheep's sword, and I can, and of course, his sword has always been a part of his personality, and he throws the sword away.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't just set it there. He actually throws it away to where he
yeah, this is like Superman hanging up his cape or Batman, you know, caving in the Batcave. It's like totally iconic for the character. And now he doesn't care about it. You're supposed to go, whoa, this is terrible. But Reepicheep doesn't care. It's just an added little symbol there. His sword now and what it can do and what he's done with it and the acclaim that he's won with it now no longer matters. Aslan's country is all that matters.
Yeah, and I think that that was just one more thing that just kind of told me. I just don't think that. I think it was unintentional. I think that it just was the book was misunderstood.
Yes.
It wasn't clear to them what was really going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, they've already made Aslan's country into a bonus. And so it just seems contradictory for suddenly it's a bonus for everybody else, but it's just the only place that Reepicheep ever wanted to go. But it's almost like to use the Disney World comparison, it's like going to Disney World and the smallest character in the group is wanting to ride Dumbo the Flying Elephant. Oh boy, Dumbo the Flying Elephant! Wow, I can get on these little elephants that spin round and round and round, and everybody's like, okay, good for you. I hope you enjoy that. Of course, then, yeah. Everybody else will be wanting to go ride Space Mountain or something, which is much more amazing. But no one else seems to identify with that desire. It's just Reepicheep's thing. But again, also in the book, of course, Reepicheep is the one who's been most unabashed about wanting to go to Aslan's country. And he's not trying to use anything as a ticket. And that is another element here that is just disturbing, again, is the humanism that comes through.
The character here is not trying to use anything as a ticket, but it's...
Yes, but everybody else tells him, yes.
It's the affirmation, not even... even if it were just Aslan, I could say, that was kind of careless to just write that dialogue in there. It wasn't really clear on what that... But the fact that Edmund and Caspian aren't contradicted, it's just kind of... You know, if it's said in a movie and it's not contradicted, it's kind of It's just assumed, you know.
Yeah, it's just out there, exactly. Yeah. But again, it is the humanism though that comes through, similar to the whole thing with Eustace being a dragon, being the greatest thing that happened to them because they managed to defeat all their enemies with his help and all that. Eustace's dragon is not so terrible now. It's awesome, you know. Wow, you're a powerful dragon. Same thing with Reepicheep though. I mean, it doesn't help just to say, well, you're small of stature, but you have a noble heart. It's the exact same thing. Yeah. You have inner goodness, and you have fought to do more with that goodness, and that's what's going to get you in. My country was made for noble hearts. That's how I hear it. They may have meant something else. It just like you said, it's just, and then
you know, there is an element of, oh, you have to be deserving. And that's something that, you know, Lewis doesn't make a clear statement of, okay, here's the process on how the beavers, who are not perfect beings, are able to go to Aslan's country.
And yeah,
here's
and how I don't expect people. That. Yeah, some people
no,
do.
You know,
I don't.
But there's some things that Lewis just kind of leaves unsaid and doesn't try to go into, but there's some things he doesn't say that would kind of mess that up.
Yes, but I do wish that the writers had. I mean, The Great Divorce is probably Lewis's best work on this, where Lewis, through this allegory of the afterlife, is telling people how he thinks of heaven, and when people are showing up at heaven, you know, trying to get in, but they want to get in and do something else, and that they're constantly told no. You know, it's all about wanting to be here. For its own value, that sort of thing. And golly, I wish that they'd read that, and then maybe they could have... You know, they may not have agreed with it, but they would have gone, okay, I think I see what he's getting at there.
Let's go to a piece that this has... The monologue from Aslan here, or the dialogue between he and Lucy, has a long history just on the Narnia Web forums and discussions. We found out... A lot of us were concerned that they would remove one of the famous lines, where he says... In your country, in your world, I have another name. And a lot of people were afraid, okay, this is going to be too much for them, that we know they're probably going to remove it. And we found out that apparently this was a big issue, and some people like Gresham really fought for this. And it's in the movie almost verbatim.
They changed that name. You must learn to know me by that name, too. You must learn to know me by it. That's it. That's the only change that I found.
Yeah, so I didn't really find. I listened to it again. I didn't find anything really substantive. It wasn't exactly verbatim, but I couldn't find anything really to complain about. But, how did you feel just as in this scene? How did you feel that moment worked? What did it do? How do you think it worked for the movie?
Again, having the same cartridge in book cartridge instead of movie cartridge, especially with that. Going into it, I loved it. I imagine I could go back and over-analyze it and try to persuade myself based on all the other things I got wrong that I didn't love it, but I have to admit I do. And it's though because I was a book reader, and I these themes are very personal to me also. I'm aware of the double meanings there, you know, the most clear statement that Aslan is a representation of Christ in that world, and I mean, everybody knows that, and even secular readers of Narnia, you know, they're okay with that, just because it's great storytelling. And I was very glad that even if there was a big battle beforehand, that those lines got in there. You know, I'm sure they could have been done better, acted better. You know, Lucy could have been more desperate or whatever, you know, more relieved afterward or something, and maybe you're about to say some of that, but I liked it when I first saw it. I mean, I was crying. I don't mind saying that I cried in movies. And partly it's because, not just because I love the story so much, but because the themes, the real world equivalent, are so personal to me now.
I think that for me, my first impression was, they're quoting the book. What a great idea. That was the first thing that really came to my head.
Absolutely stunning reversal of fortunes, ladies and gentlemen.
But personally, and actually one of my friends... He said that this is a friend who does not profess to be a Christian at all, and he understands the allegorical aspects. Well, not allegorical, but I should say representative
supposal.
Aspects. But he thought that part of the movie just kind of jumped out and just seemed really odd to him. And I said, well, that part is in the book. But I said, but as I was thinking about it, and even in the film watching it, I felt like there was a little bit of a disconnect between just the development of Aslan throughout the film up to that point. I felt like it just seemed like it
Do you mean
I
it
could say
didn't
it came
seem
out of
like the same
nowhere, but
Aslan? Seemed like a
yeah,
different Aslan?
it seemed like it was very obvious to me who's I it just seemed like it jumped out to me, and maybe this is only because I read the book, that I know where this material is coming from versus wait a minute, Aslan didn't show up at Deathwater. Wait a minute, look at that dialogue with Aslan and Lucy in the mirror. These other things just kind of it seemed like such a different Aslan that it I think that the other changes, it wasn't this change, it wasn't this element. I think it was the others that just kind of made it feel like it felt a little awkward to me that we had what I saw to be a contrast. Am I really glad they had the line in there? Yeah, I'm glad they had the line in there. I just felt like, well, what does it really mean anymore with these other changes and statements about who Aslan is? So, as far as a criticism of this scene, it's not a criticism. But I will say that the power of this scene was negated by things that happened earlier.
Yes,
Does
and
that
if
make
I hadn't been if I hadn't been able to switch cartridges, it would have been negated for me also. I think I did just kind of switch, and then it had more meaning because I knew what the original context was, and I was able to get that back silently, mentally, as I was sitting there viewing it. And I think that's a great point that this does seem like a very different Aslan because the previous sightings of Aslan we've seen in the film, I'm sure they didn't intend to mess him up at all. But this was humanism Aslan. This was not an Aslan who would very very lovingly, humbly. He's crazy enough to be lovingly, humbly presenting himself as the best that someone could have. And that is what I think strikes us as so different because Aslan doesn't tell Lucy at the end what the previous versions of Aslan would have said is like you have much to do, you have so much to grow into, you have it within yourself to be the best you can be, all kinds of cliches maybe written better than I'm paraphrasing now, but that's what the previous version of Aslan would have told them. In essence, you don't need me. I've given you these gifts, now go use them. I'm no big deal. I'll still be here and you'll have the memory of me, et cetera, et cetera. But for him to actually say, to endorse Lucy's belief that we're nothing without you, Aslan, and in essence he says, yes, I know, so I'm there too, and I love you and I'll be with you, and you must learn to know me by that other name. That's arrogant. That and one could almost say that, wow, how arrogant of Aslan to do that, even though he's very soft and very kind when he says it. But of course, book readers will know that it's not arrogant at all. If it's the truth, if Aslan is the greatest person they could ever know, then it would be not loving for him to withhold himself. That's why Narnia book fans are weeping when Aslan says that, and other people going, okay, this is confusing. Or even imagine some people would go, this is offensive.
Well, I think my friend was just kind of going, okay, I get it. He's Jesus. That was, his attitude. But now I think that, the point here is that, yeah, he's in both worlds. He's bigger than just what's going on right there. And
Which is huge for
it
the
should
series.
tie into the desire for Aslan's country and all that. And, again, this is not really my criticism of the movie at this point. It's more, this is what's been, how it's, this scene, even this great line has been handicapped. And, from this point of the movie, actually forward, there were some other pieces of dialogue, with Edmund and Lucy. Edmund saying, "Well, I'm okay with going back to our world now." And it seemed like kind of a poorly worded wrap up to his character development. But a lot of it from this point on, I really liked the movie. I really loved it, actually.
I love the visual effects where the wave, of course, and they walk in. I didn't mind that there wasn't a door in the air. I thought that was a very, very creative way and very, very original. We've never seen anything like that in a film before.
It was great. I thought that was
It
a
was wonderful,
wonderful
spellbinding.
way to exit it. They did have to compact the scene. In the book, you have Aslan's not there by the wave. They actually walk for quite a ways until they come to a piece of grass where they
Oh,
find a
yes.
lamb. And I didn't, for the sake of time, because I imagine time was the one of the reasons they changed all that. I didn't mind that they compacted it so much. But yeah, I thought for one thing, just creatively, okay, we're going to have them swimming up, and then it's going to look like they seamlessly enter our world. And I watched that scene three times, and I thought, wow, they're coming up out of the water, and they're perfectly dry. This is just like how it would be. Like, if it were really magical, this is exactly like how it would be. There's water on the floor, but the floor is not wet when the water recedes, you know?
Yes, that was absolutely wonderful and original and creative and not in the book, and it worked so seamlessly. I haven't seen any book fan stuck up about details like me complain about that. That's because the spirit was there. You could tell. You could tell there was heart in that.
Yeah. Now, and even one thing one of the book really wraps up really quickly. I mean, you have on one page, you have Lucy saying, "Is Eustace never to come back either?" And Aslan says, "Do you really need to know that?"
Mm-hmm. And that's all he says. That's the climax, though. Now, I think that's why it seems to be so abrupt, because you know, it's just really quick details about how they get back to our world. The climax and the end.
Only
is
two more
happened.
Things need to be told.
And yes. Then
You know, and then it has a kind of a funny. Ending with Aunt Alberta, you'd never know him for the same boy.
Yes.
It became very tiresome and commonplace. But what did you think? They gave Eustace a little bit of a monologue. The film almost opens on his monologue.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit. I mean, it does not open on his monologue, but it's pretty early in the film. And then it closes with his monologue. Even there, that was creative writing completely outside the book.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't using that material there. What did you think of it?
From a sense of continuity, I loved it, especially because some films will, especially some of the older Disney animated cartoons, will open up with the narration and then completely forget about it.
Yeah.
And this here, it is bookended quite neatly.
Mm-hmm.
And it the subtlety is there. And Eustace's voice sounds different. He sounds more serious. He has a sense of wonder in his voice about what has just happened. And you hear him say that he misses cousins with all his heart. That line's not in the book, but you know that Book Eustace would have said that, because they've been through so much together. And he now sees, obviously, that they weren't making up Narnia at all. Not only that, but he knows that Narnia is this absolutely wonderful place, and he's encountered Aslan. And,
from when they talk to Aslan, they're back in his room, and they're all just looking at each other. The acting, the music.
It's quiet.
This is easily
no
the
need
best.
To talk. Yeah.
Yeah,
wonderful.
The best piece of music. Yeah, there's nothing said. I love that. They just look at one another, and they know they don't have to say anything.
I love
that. And then you get Eustace's little monologue. And I actually kind of thought it was kind of I don't know if it was intentional. If it is, I thought it was actually a pretty clever little kind of double entendre where he says, I miss them with all my heart, as I know Narnians will miss them till the end of time.
Uh-huh.
Which, if you think about it, if you just take it at face value, yes, they'll miss them forever. It's kind of, but no, he's actually saying, because there is a time when they will miss them until the end of time, when they will no longer miss them, because they are reunited. And I don't know if that was intentional, but it wouldn't surprise me.
I would hope that it was intentional, because you think of Father Time standing up with his big trumpet and then squeezing out the sun and all of that. And, of course, that's when true Narnians, find their kings and queens again, and everybody's all reunited. So maybe they were thinking of that. I mean, Andrew Adamson and his producers and the designers were thinking about that when they put the patterns from The Magician's Nephew into the designs of the wardrobe. So I would not be surprised, especially because the ending was so well-crafted. And almost wish that they'd kept that sensibility throughout other parts of the film, but it just had this classic feel to it. Even when doesn't Eustace hang up the painting again?
Yeah, Eustace hangs it up
very reverently, softly.
Yeah,
he was so critical about it before, and now look, he sees art different. You know, in the book they say don't let him get started about art and all that, and he said,
"Well, there's also
a picture.
Ship sailing away as he hangs up the painting." So I'd say that's pretty cool.
That's a bit of you got a newfound respect for these things, and you know that's almost a sense that was missing in some of the film itself, where you didn't have a respect for the other, the magical other that is worth anything to experience. And Eustace acts like I wish some of the parts of the film had acted, and that was wonderful.
Well, there was, and as I was watching this the second time, I thought, I hope that if I'd been the director of this scene if I were in charge of the film and I'd been doing this scene, I hope I would do it exactly like this, because this is, I can't really improve upon this. With one little exception, one guy I know said, oh, they ruined the ending with that part about Jill Pohl. I didn't ruin it for me. I think it would have been better if they just left it out, because it does kind of create a problem of, you know, for book fans who know that they weren't actually friends, even though Aunt Alberta doesn't imply necessarily that she's a friend. She doesn't say she's come over to play, it's just that she's come over to see you. Or has come to call. So it's not necessarily a plot hole, although I thought it was seemed like a little bit of a, here fans, when the fans are kind of saying, no thank you. I think that's really, it was just a minor annoyance, it wasn't really a big deal to me.
I concur, I just think that it could be a plot hole later. Why would Jill be coming to see him? Jill can't stand him. They go to a boarding school that presumably accepts students from all over the country. Would Jill even live in the same town as Eustace?
Right.
No, why would she want to have anything to do with this snotty kid whom she cannot stand? And she doesn't know he's changed.
She's going to throw a rotten tomato in his face.
Yes. Then. Well, see, of course, it could be that. Yeah, you did this to me.
Picks up, you know, 5 minutes after this one, and you know, boom.
Yeah,
you know, right.
But it's in the middle of the holidays, though. You know, these kids have gone back home. They're not thinking about the other students. If anything, Jill would just want to get away with him. The only way that would make really a lot of sense is if they absolutely changed Jill's and Eustace's relationship at the beginning of The Silver Chair, whenever they do film that. And, you know, that being as adversarial as it is and almost modern feeling, they can't change that. You know, that unlike the siblings, they Lewis has already written that they can't stand each other, at least before Eustace changed, and they always have that baggage throughout their journey.
Well, I think that, you know, it was just a clumsy little annoyance to me.
Clumsy or annoying as some of the other changes that were made, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, I have to talk about one more really positive thing, and then we'll really wrap up briefly. The end credits.
Aww.
Not the end credits song, but as I was watching the end credits, I thought, it was kind of sad that I was almost more excited about the end credits than any other part of the movie, but I thought, this is one of the best ideas.
If any
of the crew are listening, if anyone, whether it was Apted or whoever it was who thought of putting in the Pauline Baynes illustrations, kudos to you.
Yes,
and animating
yes.
them.
You win 1,000 points and a bonus trip to Aslan's country. Ding, 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 ding.
Yeah. Yeah, it was great. Actually, I still haven't really looked up the lyrics of the song. It didn't do much for me.
But you didn't like "We Can Be the Kings and Queens of Anything If We Believe"?
No, but
I didn't
like
either.
I didn't like watching the paintings.
Mm-hmm. Me too. It kept me sitting through the ending credits for sure. Trying not to listen to the song, enjoying the sound of the song, just not liking their lyrics so much at all. I wish that they put Scott Crepane's song at the end, but I like his song about Voyage, inspired by Voyage of the Dawn Treader. So, you know, it's a little bit more about the transcendent themes and the storytelling and the adventure and stuff. I think it would have gone better, but hey, I understand these decisions have to be made. But oh, those illustrations. Mm-hmm. I'm playing them in my head right now.
Yeah. Well, they're great. Dr. Ransom, if anyone who had listened to all of these little pieces on analysis,
I have summed up
all the hours. I think we've almost gone longer. I don't think we've gone longer than the length of the theatrical Lord of the Rings, but we almost have with our just the length of our analysis.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you, a lot of people could just say, "Oh yeah, I've listened to this. I know what their overall opinions are." If you were to just kind of sum it up in a couple sentences, how would you sum up the film? And even if you have to differentiate between the film and the adaptation.
The adaptation was woeful. Woeful most of the time. Woeful. W-O-E-F-U-L. as a story, now this is why a lot of book readers like Prince Caspian as a story. The film is a story, while the adaptation, they think, you know, could have been better, because at least they got a lot of the themes right. and it hung together as a story. What the characters did, even if not exactly matching the book, was believable. Don Treader adaptation was rather lousy most of the time. And as a story, it just, you know, one little push and a plot hole opens up. We've gone over many of those plot holes, and that those parts aren't nitpicking the adaptation. I mean, it may sound like that, but it's just asking, okay, what about this? And that's just mm-hmm. something you expect of a good movie, even if it completely trounces the book and just, you know, takes mm-hmm. the names and the characters and that's it. It has to make sense as a story. And there were a lot of points where it just did not. And mm-hmm. so I wanted to like it so much and was very disappointed. Overall very disappointed, apart from the good parts, a lot of which we've talked about just now.
Yeah. I think that as an adaptation, my opinion, though, the second time watching the film did not change of the adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
The adaptation, I would say, it was a film of the same title that told a story that I cannot imagine Lewis would or could have written.
Mm-hmm.
Him being who he was. And I would say it was a, without trying to be mean, it was a very poor adaptation
mm-hmm.
of the book. Not the worst I have seen, but a very poor adaptation of the book. As a film, the first time I kind of came away from it, I thought, this was a bad movie.
Mm-hmm.
This wasn't even okay. It was a bad movie. The second time I watched it, I started realizing more and more how they had kind of, the dialogue, it was very simple, they dumbed things down, they stated the obvious, there was not a lot of nuance. Mm-hmm. I realized, this is not a bad movie, this is a mediocre children's film.
Yeah.
It's really, it reminded me of other, you know, kind of children's fantasy films I'd seen, Legends of the Seeker, you know, which I could say, hey, it had this cool thing and this cool thing here, but overall, it just was not a children's film that was very well done.
Yeah, so you have to grade on a curve, in other words.
I kind of do. I mean, mm-hmm. I have to. I want to recognize, okay, what were they trying to be? And I realize more and more, the more I see it, they were making this more for children
mm-hmm.
than
and families.
Families. Yeah, you know, watching The Incredibles, that was made for families. Watching the Pixar
uh-huh,
films, those
true.
Are made for
mm-hmm.
so little kids and adults will enjoy it to the same extent. I really think that younger kids enjoy this film more than adults, and you know, it didn't really hold much substance. And so that's really my only trying to sum it up is I just thought, you know, as an adaptation, yes, it was poor. As a film, it wasn't bad. I think in many ways, overall, it was probably more positive a film than Star Wars Episode II.
Yes, compared to that.
I mean, really. And I, you know, I've watched that multiple times. It's, I think that it just, as a kid's movie, it's just, it's not a great kid's movie.
Mm-hmm.
So
even grading on a curve, it gets what would you assign an American
school system
letter?
It does better
letter?
On a curve.
Okay. To briefly sum up for international listeners, in America, F is a failing grade. A is absolutely, you know, amazing grade. What grade would you give it, even on the curve of this is supposed to be a children's movie?
I would, in the curve, I would probably give it a C+.
Mm.
You know, definitely, you know, as far as if a lot of children's fantasy films, it's nothing, it does not stand out as being a great one or
mm-hmm.
a good one. I would say there's a lot of things that are really cool about it. They do a good job with the sea serpent battle. There's definitely some things that are just as a film, it gets some high marks for. Our acting really is, overall, maybe even the best of all three. At least with the principal cast.
Mm-hmm.
Will Poulter still gets really high marks. So
yes, absolutely.
There's some great stuff. I just think, you know, in C is considered average. It's
mm-hmm.
not considered terrible. It's considered average. I would not say it was a failure as a film. As an adaptation, I would probably give it closer to a D.
Mm-hmm. I'd give it an F for adaptation. Maybe F plus based on
I've never seen an F plus.
Oh well, that's what happens when I'm homeschooled, trying to guess at the grades, and it's been a while since I've been in college. But okay, so D minus maybe. Even grading on the curve for a children's movie, though, I almost expect, at least now, with so many films being made, as you mentioned, The Incredibles, that appeal to both children and families, to all children and families and adults and geeks, you know, and Pixar's films hit that sweet spot for all four of those groups. You know, it's a date movie and a kid's movie and an action movie all in one. You know, not everybody can be Pixar, but when you have this kind of source material, it's not impossible to appeal to all of them. I recently saw Thor, the new Marvel superhero film, which I don't know if it was the director or the scriptwriters, the producers or what, but they understood transcendence in that film. I mean, it's about the Norse god, you know, but they never call him a god. So, you know, if you get offended at that sort of thing, you're okay. He's more like a really advanced alien civilization. And they captured, though, that wonder of the realm where he lived, and, you know, this is, wow, this is amazing, this is lofty, this is regal, you know. They made this very traditional stuff, you know, with the king, and you have to obey the king and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And also it was very clear that Thor himself had a lot to learn, and where the character succeeded so much is where he knew that he didn't have all these great things inside himself. He had to learn and be humble and all that. Not to spoil that, but I know that it can be done. If someone took a look at Dawn Treader and said, this is too big, you know, too many themes here, we don't get them. Audiences these days want something more. They want to be told they're great and have their self-esteem built up, and we want to have adventure and quests instead of to save the world instead of, you know, giving everything up for Aslan's country. What's that all about? Well, I know that it can be done. I've seen it done, and not just in Thor, you know, which I saw yesterday. I've seen it done in other films, and if Lewis can do it in such a simple children's story, it could have made for us a much better film, adaptation and story for the movie itself.
Well, we still know very little about the writing crew and everything on The Magician's Nephew, so...
Mm-hmm.
Who knows?
Maybe that'll be better. I would hope so. I would hope so.
Well, that concludes our time. And Dr. Ransom, thank you and everyone. Thanks to Glumpuddle, thanks to JimFan15, and Warrior for Jesus, who all pitched in on these analyses.
It has been an amazing series, and I'm privileged to get on and jaw about Narnia, you know. We read in The Last Battle that's one of the most fun things all the seven friends of Narnia can do. So we have, how many is that? What, five friends of Narnia taking turns on these podcasts? It has been
We have some
exhilarating.
Every once in a while, Tyrion will come on, or Fantasia Kitty's been on as
well. Well, specifically for the, that's right, Tyrion did join in for a part of the analysis, if I remember. But yes, it is such fun. It is a privilege. The salary is awesome. With benefits, people.
Awesome. I am continually amazed at how much I get paid for the work I put in.
Wow, and yeah, you get what you pay for. Somebody had to say it. Might as well be me. Really, no, the rewards are just the fun of it. And knowing that others get to join in by listening and commenting. I've been keeping up with all the comments on the podcast episodes, even the ones I haven't been in. I look forward to seeing the comments for this one.
Indeed. Thank you very much, Dr. Ransom.
All right. Thank you again, Prince Rillian.
And that's it.
Ah, what a long exam.